Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey y'all, welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. It is Friday, May 6th, 2022, here on the Chase Thomas Podcast, and I appreciate you guys for joining today's program. So, very, very jam-packed show for you guys today to get your weekend started off right. Yeah, we've got a lot of guests on this edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. We have Stats by Will, who returns to talk all things college basketball, Antonio Reeves winding up at Kentucky, Hubert Davis landing G.G. Jackson, Tennessee in the portal, and then a season review, KenPom Top 25. We're going to do this for each team, 25 down from the great KenPom's rankings. So we started off with San Diego State there. Then we also get into some more great stuff on this edition of the podcast. Yeah, we're not done. We are not done. We also have Brian Finneran of 680 to the Fan, who came on to talk all things Falcons, the receiver position, the Falcons draft, Drake London, his time playing the position of wide receiver. And yeah, so that was great talking with Brian over there at 680 to the Fan. And then ESPN's Jesse Rogers, the great ESPN Major League Baseball reporter, Chicago insider. Jesse Rogers comes on to talk about the Cubs, the White Sox, Major League Baseball, the sad state of the Reds, and what's going on with the ball and why hitting is down all across the board the first month of the Major League Baseball season. So all that and more coming up on this edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Don't forget, folks, yeah, we're on YouTube. You can go check us out on YouTube.com. Type in the Chase Thomas Podcast. You'll find every episode of this very program on the YouTube page, and it's free and easy to subscribe to, and it features all the different guests on a video form if you would prefer to watch this program rather than just listen to it. If you've not already done so, please, please, please make sure that you go ahead and hit that pause button right now and leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or however you are listening to this podcast. It helps more than you know, and it helps other people find the show and all that great stuff. You can also read me, Sports Renaissance Man. Sports Renaissance Man, that's me. SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com. Tap your email and become a subscriber there. That's always a great way to support everything I've got going on the writing front. And then follow me on Twitter at Chase_Thomas and like the Facebook page at facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter. All right, Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas podcast, where I am joined by one of my favorites, Stats by Will. Will Warren with the stash that you can see on YouTube.com. Type in the Chase Thomas podcast. You'll see an amazing crew neck of the Nashville Predators.
Let me pull it up so people can see it.
Oh, man, that is top-notch stuff. That is top-notch stuff. And then we've got this unreal stash that Will's got going. Will, how is the wife handling the stash? Is she on board with it? What does she feel? Because my fiance, I can say that now because I have a fiance.
Yes, congrats.
Thank you, sir. She hates when I grow out the goatee. Hates it. She's like, it's prickly. I can't deal with it. It's uncomfortable. Not a fan. But I want to be a goatee guy. Like, I'm ready to just go full goatee. I want to do that. So you've been able to persuade at least somewhat, right? Like, is she on board, or is she like, no, this is not staying after the playoffs?
She's told me before she likes it. So,
okay.
I think this is, I'm going to say this is in part because I've never really had one for longer than like 3 to 5 days at a time. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, if the Predators do something unusual and this goes like 2 or 3 weeks, she might change her tune. But for now, I think she's okay with it. I mean,
how do you trim it? Do you do the little scissors and you just across, or no?
Depends. So I own a one blade, the Phillips one.
Okay.
This is not an ad, but I do love it a lot. So I trim around the lips a little bit and then up towards the nose somewhat. And in the past when I've done this, I've used like a beard trimmer to sort of get it, but I don't find it quite as successful. So I will be honest, I don't know what I'll do with it if this goes on for a few weeks, but
is it itchy?
No, not really. See, that is my problem with growing a beard, is I find it really itchy after about 2 weeks in. And I feel okay with the look of a beard on myself, but I don't like how it feels, especially when it gets really hot here, as it does for like 7 months now out of the year in Knoxville. It just doesn't feel good when you have like sweat pulling underneath. Not a good vibe. So I generally will just shave after a couple of weeks. But I don't know, I kind of like the look of it. When I'm running now, when I'm running and I've got the headband and the sunglasses, I had to run with sunglasses today. So I thought it was a good look. So I don't know. We'll give this another week. And if the Predators continue giving up 7 goals, it may not be long for use. But, hey, got to stay positive.
Are you going to go to any games?
I'm going to game 3 on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Which is exciting. I have not been to a playoff game with my dad in probably 5 years. So
is he all into him? Big Preds guy?
Big Preds guy. We both watch like 90% of the games, I would say. So they were my first sports team that I was really into. Growing up, like even before basketball and whatnot. So yeah, I've always been a huge fan.
There you go. My team's left, so I am a quote-unquote Preds guy for now. But I mean, just losing the Thrashers, like it was I don't have a home. Like
you no longer have Ilya Kovalchuk on your side. We're Danny Heatley,
Ilya Kovalchuk.
I feel like they had a good goalie for a bit too, but I can't recall.
I forgot. We did, and I'm trying to forget. We had what's his name before? The Evander Kane. We were in that's how long he's been in the league. We had Evander Kane a long time ago. Yeah. Leave the memories alone. Believe in Blue Land. Never forget. But yeah, that's where we're at. Stats by Will. So we have some college basketball that we need to hit on today. And I think we start with Kentucky, where Antonio Reeves winds up sharp, goes to the draft without playing 1 second for the Kentucky Wildcats. But what did you make of Reeves winding up at Kentucky, and then Kellen Grady, and how like other potential transfers looked at that as like, I forget which transfer target looked at Kentucky and was like, I don't want to be his role, I don't want to fall into the same category that Grady. And it was like, a lot of people were like, well, I mean, he was their top scorer and he was doing a lot of stuff. It worked out pretty well. Like that's a pretty good thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, what do you make of the current Kentucky Wildcats transfer situation and how Reeves wound up at Kentucky?
So I think before you start any discussion about the Kentucky Wildcats, I think we should remind everyone that Kentucky lost to a 15 seed, and it was the funniest thing that has ever happened in basketball history, short of Duke losing to a 15 seed, which was also pretty good.
Yeah.
But that being said, again, reminder, Kentucky lost to a 15 seed with the National Player of the Year.
That's true.
I'm interested. So I wrote this in my notes. This is like a very specific test for Tennessee writer me of the meme of the advanced stats nerd versus that boy nice. Yeah. So on paper, Reeves really doesn't move the needle much for me. His defensive metrics at Illinois State were horrendous. He rarely, if ever, made any positive impact on D. A scan of the in-game videos leads me to believe he was barely involved unless it was 100% required of him. That does not fly with Cal. That is not a way to stay on the floor for 30 plus minutes, even really 20 plus at Kentucky. Cal does not really, I know he's played guys like, you know, when they really needed shooting, they were playing Davion Mintz or whatever other guy it was that's sort of lost to time from that 9-16 team. That was like the one other shooter. I cannot recall his name right now. but like guys who were not good defensively, but they just needed to play.
Mm.
Kentucky is not like that anymore. But that being said, I think this could just be a thing of players will commit to playing harder defense if it, you know, will benefit the team. Like, it's sort of how Tennessee added James Daniel from Howard. Daniel had horrendous defensive metrics there. Then when he came to Tennessee, he was fine. It was just all about, like, if you're not having to commit so much energy offensively night after night after night like he did for Illinois State, you've probably got more to save up for defense, and you can put in more on that end. Because it does require a lot of energy to play quality defense. I mean, Santiago Vescovi found that out this year, I think.
Wait, hold on. Vescovi is ready. That man, I would love to spend, like, hey, Tennessee, hit me up. I want to do the feature story on his running workouts, because Will and I are runners, and that man has to be an avid runner. There's no way around it. That man must be hitting the treadmill. He's hitting something, because, folks, if you want to get a workout just by not even moving your body, just watch Santiago Vescovi run around for 30 minutes at a time. Like, it's an unreal thing to watch what he was doing this past year. That man was in shape. Yes. Now, was it because he changed his hair color back to normal? Can we rule that out, that he didn't have the highlights and suddenly he's in shape? What happened there? People are wondering.
Also, got to shout out Vescovi. He looks great in the One Knoxville SC kit that they've been posting on social media. Mm. Anyway, back to the person this segment is supposedly about, Antonio Reeves. He's also a career 34% three-point shooter. He's got one good deep shooting season, bounced against two mediocre ones. So I'm kind of waiting to see which side that's more on, because it's like 29, 32, and then out of nowhere, 39% on double the attempts. So I don't really know how that works out long-term. That being said, this is a 6'5" guy. Some are saying 6'6". It kind of depends where you look. Hit 60% of his attempts at the rim, 46% for mid-range, which is terrific. Rarely turned the ball over despite being the obvious number one scoring option on a bad Illinois State team. And, I mean, averaged almost 20 a game. Like, he's a legit scorer. He was really, really good for a team that needed him to be really, really good. Otherwise, they would have won, like, 8 games. So, frankly, I don't know what to think in full, which is okay. I mean, I don't think we have to have a full take yet. Grady, since we brought him up, was easier for me to project because both he and Davidson were pretty good. And you could say, yeah, it makes sense that Kellen Grady is going to be at least pretty good at Kentucky. And, you know, I mean, the point of a guy not wanting to be him being a role player is funny, because it's like Kellen Grady arguably got way more exposure playing for Kentucky than he would have for Davidson. So even if you're a role guy, you're going to get a lot more exposure playing for UK. Reeves is a little tougher to project because he put up all those excellent offensive stats on a bad basketball team with no other real options. And at least on paper, it doesn't feel like he's going to be number one scoring option for UK when you have Shibwe and Wheeler coming back. And even some of the other guys on that roster could end up ahead of him in scoring. So can a bulldog type like that transition into more of a helper role without sacrificing what made him worth taking in the first place would be my question. So that's a move I'm all right with. I like it. I don't know that it really changes Kentucky materially for me yet, because I already thought of them as like kind of an obvious top three team next year. So I think they're...
Who's your
top
three right now?
That's the problem, is I don't know that there is an obvious top three.
Well, everyone seems to think that it's UNC as one. Like, I'm seeing a lot of early UNC one, which is, I know, something that you're not on board with.
I don't get it. I would have UNC like sixth. And that's no disrespect to UNC. It's more about like... it's sort of the UCLA thing from last year. People who are putting UNC number one overall, and I'm not saying it's indefensible. I mean, you can at least make an argument for it, but I wouldn't do it. People who are doing that are just kind of like conveniently ignoring November through February UNC and being like, oh, March UNC is all UNC is bringing back to this year. It's like March UCLA was not all of UCLA this past season. They had some pretty... I mean, they were still really good, and they were a top eight team, but they had down stretches that resulted in them being a four seed. It's like, it's kind of convenient to think UNC is suddenly going to be number one after really being a bubble team right on the fence for 4 months. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I would have Kentucky in the top three. I think Baylor is a top three team. I know Matthew Mayer is transferring, but it's sort of like Scott Drew is more or less earned the benefit of the doubt at this point. And they have a really talented roster coming back. And sickeningly, and this is not something that I wanted to be saying, I think Duke would be the third of the three. just a lot of talent. I don't know how Shire's going to do year one, but it's sort of like...
They have the two. They have number one and number two in the class, don't they? Yeah,
they do. And it's like they got enough talent coming back. They got enough talent coming in. And it's sort of like when a mid-major coach, and this is not the same situation at all, but it's the closest comparison in my head. When like a mid-major coach goes 12-0 in college football and leaves, but like the starting quarterback comes back and the next guy goes 11-1 by default.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel the situation John Shire is stepping into. It's like most of the work is done for him.
He
just has to go
Peyton.
Out and not suck. And I don't think I feel like he has a baseline of at least being fine.
There's no path to them falling out. Like, it's just, Duke is now such an institution and the recruiting is just not, they're fine. Yeah. Like, it's just,
they'll be good. I mean, it's just like, it's hard to imagine any scenario where they're not like, I mean, like the low end scenario for them to me is like their top 10 next year, like a 3 seed or whatever. And considering it's a first year head coach taking over after a guy who was there for 30 something years, could be a whole lot worse than top 10 in year one.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's kind of like the lower end to me. So
for sure. For sure. Well, we mentioned UNC a little bit here. Hit me with the Gigi Jackson stuff, because Gigi is a gigantic recruiting get for North Carolina, which I have never really gotten like the full answer as to why they've fallen off in recent years in recruiting and why they're not a traditional powerhouse still in college basketball recruiting. Like, that's like, you look at this past team, this is a great example, like Caleb Love and the rest of this group, like, they're good players. Like, Black's a good player, but they're not, none of these guys are NBA guys, or at the very least there's no lottery guys, there's no Kennedy Chandlers in these recruiting classes. And it's kind of interesting because you just don't think of UNC like that, as the team of like, we're here because we love college basketball and we're running it back and we don't care about the NBA and we're doing this. Like, it's just the Jerry Stackhouse and Rashad McCants years, though. Those were years and years ago, the Vince Carter years, everything like that. But I don't know, what do you think of Jackson, and how does he fit with a roster that is bringing everybody back? Like, that might be an interesting thing to monitor for Hubert, is that, like, this is your biggest recruiting get in your time. Obviously, it's been brief, but you want to set the right tone with him. Like, you want to get him involved. You want to do stuff. But it also, it seems like, might work into what you're saying, where you're like, well, he could help in those months from November to February where UNC was not what we saw in the tournament. And this is might be the buffer, is more depth so that they can be more of the team that we saw in the tournament throughout the year, with the more depth where you don't have to play your starters until they die on the court. Like, there might be a scenario where you don't have to do that next year. So I don't know, what do you make of Gigi, and do you think it's a big turning point guy for the Tar Heel program?
So first, I'm gonna stand by a take I fired off after the title game, which is that Hubert should have retired right there.
Ooh.
How exactly are you going to get better than, one, ending your hated rival's career with a loss in the Final Four and in his final home game against you? Two, making it to the title game as an 8 seed, which, I mean, I know that had happened like in our lifetimes with Butler, but it's still crazy hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then three, coming up just 3 points short of a title, really that 1-3 short of a title. We already touched on UNC first overall in the way too early top 25s, which, I mean, for me, it's like, that's more worth reading for a laugh than for anything serious. And again, seems like a death knell for the repeat hopes. I don't feel like I've ever seen a team that was number one in a way too early top 25 win at all. But again, really good for famed underdog North Carolina to get the next great front court star there.
Yeah.
So they have some interesting stay-go decisions for next season with Love and with a couple other guys that could impact this. But I think as of now, Gigi Jackson, fairly obvious day one starter and contributor.
Who goes to the bench then?
Huh?
Who goes to the bench then?
That's a great question. That's on Hubert to find out. The upper range comp I saw for him is Carmelo, which seems pretty wild, because that's like, if you're Carmelo, you're probably going number one in the draft now.
Yeah.
But I mean, the more median outcome, which seems more realistic, but it's still really nice, is Daryl Arthur. I can't remember which it was, but like,
I think it's Daryl Arthur.
Daryl Arthur was really good for Kansas. Yeah, he was very good for Kansas and carved out that nice long NBA career where he was like a stats hero.
He was just a rebounding dude. That man was just gobbling up rebounds. He was undersized for the positions he played, but like, he was just a rebound guy.
Yeah, tough, gritty guy. So I mean, I think Jackson's going to be very, very good for them. And I want to see, you know, sort of how they play out, where he fits in the rotation. I don't know. And back on the point with UNC's recruiting, I think this is not exactly how it's always been. But, I mean, you look at the championship teams UNC has had, every single one was led by upperclassmen. I mean, yeah. You had Justin Jackson for the win over Gonzaga. Bryce Johnson, when they came up just short against Villanova, the Tyler Hansborough years, Kennedy mm-hmm. Meeks was a big part of that title team. All of those guys, juniors and seniors. And they had some help from underclass guys, but North Carolina, of the Blue Bloods, has sort of been the most reliant on the upperclassmen, I think, over the years. So, Roy never seemed to really rush towards the one and dones quite the way Kay did towards the end there. And I wonder if we'll see sort of a reversal of that with Hubert, whether Hubert is more open to taking those types and saying, I'm willing to take the risk that this guy's only here for 1 year if it means we get a Final Four bid with him.
Yeah. I don't know. That should be interesting to monitor. But either way, I think it's a good thing and a good sign for the health of North Carolina's basketball program. And I think they're moving in the right direction. I think it seems like Hubert's the guy. And the transition might be seamless, and it's going to work. But it's interesting you bring that up, because I do think that might be the pivot, is where he strays from Roy, as he gets more of the GGs and the one and dones, and worries less about the upperclassmen aspect. And also, folks, don't look up how old Tyler Hansborough is right now, because it will ruin day. You're just like, oh no, this man's almost 40. Like that, life comes at you fast. I didn't like it. I saw it the other day,
36.
See,
I don't like that he has been replaced as the first Tyler H. In the Google auto
Tyler Hero?
By Tyler Hero. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was number one for many, many years, obviously. Now it's Tyler Hero.
Legends die, man. It's just part of the business. Life keeps rolling along. Latest Tennessee notes. So I was listening to various pods. I think it was on VolQuest today when I was doing some chores around the house this morning. And I was listening to, I think it was Rob, who mentioned that there's not a lot of bigs in the portal. So it's like, to replace BHH or anything, like fans who are concerned about the big rotation, it's like, go look in the portal. There's no one there. Like, Rick Barnes is kind of strapped there. There's nobody he can really add that would move the needle at all. But what they did mention was that, hey, do not be surprised if you're going to get another Euros or a Santiago pop in to UT this summer, this fall. So it seems like there's going to be a random player that none of us know about that is just going to pop up in this roster and then be a great contributor for the next 3 years. So that is something to think about. I don't know. When you look at this depth now that Justin Powell, we have not recorded since he entered the portal. So we know Bailey's gone to George Mason. We know Powell's gone. BHH goes to Louisville. I don't know. Yuri Collins stays at St. Louis, which is a huge surprise and I think a bummer for Tennessee. I think they really thought they were going to get him, and I still don't really know why. I guess it's just because St. Louis is a top 25 team this year, and that they bring back a lot, and they should be pretty good again, and who knows? Like, maybe he's just comfortable in that scheme and where they're at, but I would love to get a deep dive into what happened there. But you also bring in Key, who I think will be an instant bucket getter and someone very important early on to get this thing moving without Kennedy Chandler running things. But I don't know, where are you at with Tennessee when you start thinking about the rotation and where they can still do stuff and the absence of Powell now?
Well, I don't really think Powell affects the projections much, frankly. Mm. I mean, he's about as translucent off the court as he was on, but he just like never really seemed to make an impact after, honestly, December. Mm-hmm. So it is what it is there. And the Yuri Collins thing, I don't think we'll ever get the full story on that. My guess is just like St. Louis probably got, for lack of a better term, they got the bag worked out for him. They probably got the NIL money straightened out, which is good. I mean, good for him if he got like a good package. So no worries there. But no, I mean, I think this is still, and I'm assuming Vescovy and Triple J are coming back, because I don't feel like either, I don't think either's NBA prospects at the moment are super sunny.
Yeah.
So
I think they're both back. Yeah.
I think they're both coming back. I would say this is a borderline top 10 roster still. The question will be really more than the roster talent for me is, with the departure of Mike Schwartz to East Carolina, who is more or less Tennessee's defensive coordinator, can they sustain that level of success there that they've built over the last 5 years without him? And then Second question that is Ross related, do they get Julian Phillips? I think that's the one that's on everybody's mind because, you know, Phillips put out his announcement graphic, you know, he's making the announcement on May 12th. There's, you know, seven things listed on it. A couple of them are G League or, you know, other professional player related, but pretty much everybody seems to believe this is coming down to Tennessee and Auburn. And the, if you read the tea leaves, people seem to believe it's Tennessee who's in the lead. And, you know, I don't have any huge hashtag sources on this, but I would, you know, lean towards that being the outcome. I think there's just more minutes for him available at Tennessee than there is within Auburn's rotation.
That's interesting because he profiles at like 6'8", 200, that tall, extremely lanky, where he's got to fill out his body. They just had that with Jabari Smith. Like, just
right.
So I wonder if, I don't know, like, is he looking at what Pearl did with Jabari and he's like, that's what I want to be used like, because that's what you're being used like all over again. I don't know. That's interesting because guess what? Tennessee will not play him like that. That is not how Rick Barnes runs things.
I mean,
things.
Maybe. But it's like, we saw Barnes really go outside of his comfort zone this year with playing three guards or Triple J at the four a lot.
But you think he would play him at the five?
I don't think he's built for the five, frankly. 6'8", 200 is not a five in really any lineup to me. But that's a guy who you're willing to let handle the ball in the perimeter, which is not really something you've had from a power forward before. So that would be nice to have. I don't really know, to be honest, what Tennessee's going to do with the other spots. I know that people seem a little pessimistic on the bigs, and I totally get it. There's no high-profile, obvious, go-get-this-guy bigs out there. But I think, you know, one, I would give it to the end of the month before really getting worried, because there's still time for people to bounce around. There's NBA draft decisions that are still being made. Like, I mean, you know, there's been plenty of talented guys to enter the portal, like, you know, KJ Williams from Murray State. Pete Nance from Northwestern is an interesting one. Obviously, Trey Mitchell at Texas, who just didn't seem to work out there. As always, the famous DJ Burns of Winthrop, who my buddy could really use a conditioning program, I hate to say. But, I mean, give a little time before freaking out. I think if they get Phillips, it's a top 10 team going into next year. It's kind of like you have a really good baseline with Rick Barnes at the helm. It's always the question of what is the ceiling? And for Tennessee to find that ceiling, it is going to be, can you get a good backup or probably honestly starter for Ziegler, who probably plays more minutes at point, but is the sixth man? And two, can you figure out something at the big man or, you know, at the five without being overly reliant on like I do having a breakout season or Kamwa coming back even better than he was before injury? Because would you like to believe that's happening? Of course. Can you count on both of those things happening? I mean, not entirely. It's a little bit of, you know, on a wing and a prayer type of thing there. So.
Yeah, and I wonder if they had known BHH was unhappy or they knew how certain things were going to go and Powell, like, would they have given Brandon Miller more attention, who local Tennessee guy who ends up at Bama? Like, those are the ones you can't lose. Like, those are the ones where that one I think will hurt a little bit more because Tennessee does not have anyone outside of Phillips on the radar in the top 50 in this class. And obviously we saw what happened last year with Idu, BHH, and Kennedy. But that's the thing that I think you, when you talk to other Tennessee fans and folks about the NIL and everything with Rick Barnes, is like he's got to adapt quickly, and this is something that we wonder is like, is this going to be a thing? Because he's going to have to recruit, and he's going to have to, the recruiting game has changed, and to keep this thing moving and to be as good as we were this past year, I think there's an expectation now around Tennessee sports and Tennessee athletics is like, you got to recruit, man, or we'll find someone who does. Like Kim English will come right back.
I think for Barnes specifically, it's like I can see a scenario where Barnes is comfortable with using NIL in the right way to boost recruiting, comfortable with getting guys. But this all comes with the knowledge that Barnes is at an advanced age and he's okaying this because he's frankly not going to be around much longer as a head coach.
Right.
So I wonder if, you know, if they get Phillips, that's probably naturally where my mind is going, is that Barnes, I mean, frankly, if you're going to get a top 10 recruit like Phillips these days, you're going to have to drop a huge NIL package.
Right.
And I don't know specifics or anything, but I mean, given the way it's going in football and given the way we saw the situation at Miami play out with Isaiah Wong, it seems obvious that that's going to happen with all top 10 top 25 recruits in all sports, or at least all major sports.
Mm.
You're going to, if they get Phillips, I think it's because, you know, Tennessee worked out the NIL thing pretty well.
Mm.
And that leads me to believe like Barnes is going all in, you know, this year's team, because I think he clearly loves James and Vescovy a lot. And, you know, maybe he sticks around for a little longer. I don't know. I don't really have any specifics on that. But you wonder if he's fine with giving more money to one player because he knows he's running out of shots at his, you know, second Final Four.
Hmm. I don't think he's wired like that. I don't think that's his thing. I think he's a process over results kind of guy.
Yeah, but when you're, you know, 68 or whatever it is,
yeah,
you got to get the results at some point.
Well, we'll see, man. I don't know. We'll see. We're going to take a quick break to pay some bills, and we'll be right back with Stats by Will. All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas Podcast with Stats by Will, one of my favorites, and I know one of y'all's favorites to have on this very program to talk all things college basketball. Will, a couple of quick things as we wrap up here on this edition of the show. Season review. I want to do this weekly with you. I think this is cool to do a deep dive, and like I want to do the start from the KenPom top 25 down, and we go from 25. It's as simple as it sounds. And number 25 this past year was San Diego State. So I want to get your perspective on the season that the Aztecs had. I mean, everyone, all eyes were on the punter situation in Aztec country this past year. And he gets drafted by the Bills in like the fourth or fifth round. So shout out to that guy who's putting on a clinic. Roger Sherman had a great write-up about him in the Ringer this fall. But what did you make of the Aztec season, Will? And is there reason for optimism going into this year?
So I think, you know, one reason for optimism is that, you know, Brady Hoke apparently has rediscovered the horseshoe.
Yeah.
That was firmly jammed up his rear his first season at Michigan. That sort of overshadowed the fact he's not very good at this. So if he can keep the horseshoe in, I mean, they could go, what was it, 11-1 or something?
Yeah. They were great.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't watch a single second of their games, but I imagine they were interesting. Anyway.
Weird thing about them, though, I will say the one weird thing about San Diego State football is their quarterback, I think his name's Hunter Johnson, he transferred to an FCS school after doing great at San Diego State this past year. Very strange. You don't see that very often.
But it's actually interesting you bring them up, because when I think of what little I know of their football program and then the basketball program, which I do know more about, I would give the exact same phrase to describe them, which is that they keep doing their thing, even if some years I find that thing incredibly hard to watch.
Yeah.
So to be frank, this past season, I had a hard time staying in love with college basketball at times, because it didn't seem as fun night to night to me. Didn't love watching it many nights, especially when the COVID breakout was happening. It was just not enjoyable to keep up with. But one of the few things that kept me tied in to the level I'm traditionally tied in was the Mountain West. Predictably, of course, all of their teams that made field immediately bowed out, so that was really wonderful. But of those teams, I would say San Diego State was the best, but the least enjoyable to watch, because they were 167th in offense, and that is barely above the national average, which is not good for a top 25 team. So they were the Sickos team of the year, a position that has been held by Wisconsin for 21 seasons until now. But this will be Brian Dutcher's sixth season in charge coming up. So 5 years in, San Diego State, which never gets high-end recruits unless they're transfers. I know, like, obviously Kawhi went there, but Kawhi was not, like, the surefire, obvious top-five recruit coming out of high school.
Mm.
So, I mean, they do not get big guys unless they're, you know, secondhand. Mm. They finished in the KenPom top 50 four times, top 30 in defense, top, you know, four times, top 20 three times now. They've only had a good offense once, which was the COVID season where the tournament was canceled, but they just keep doing their thing. This year's thing was they had precisely one good offensive player in Matt Bradley. They asked him to score as many points as they could, and they patchworked with duct tape and rubber bands the rest while putting a hammerlock on opponent offenses. I felt like this is obviously not 100% true, but I felt like every time I watched a San Diego State game, the final score was 57-56, which is, like, you know, great if you like watching the final 2 minutes of games. But The shame for them is that it felt like a lost opportunity season where they had the number two defense in America. They were tremendous every single night defensively, even made Baylor really work hard for it, or whoever it was they played early in the season. But, I mean, given how well Creighton, who beat them in the round of 64, played Kansas, it's kind of a lost chance that, you know, significantly better, at least season-long-wise, and healthier because they weren't missing multiple starters, San Diego State team failed to hold on to that 9-point lead with 3 minutes left. San Diego State could have beaten Kansas. I mean, that's a legit top 25 team playing a team that entered the field sixth in KenPom. I mean, top 25 teams beat top 10 teams all the time in college basketball, even on neutral courts. We'll never know if it could have happened, though. But the cool thing for them, you know, they won all those games. They're great all the way through. Dutcher seems to be working his way out of the shadow of Steve Fisher, which is a really hard shadow to work out of. I mean, last three seasons now, at least KenPom-wise, 6th, 30th, 25th. I mean, that's three top 30 finishes right there. Fisher, who is amazing, only had one in his final six seasons. So that's, you know, that was a program that was already good, and it seems like Dutcher's continuing to make it good and making incremental gains where he can. But, you know, the cool thing for them, Matt Bradley's coming back. So best player back. They added one of the best players in the portal and maybe my personal favorite, Darian Trimble of Seattle, who is a tremendous scorer. So Bradley will finally have scoring help, which is good. So they will be better to watch this next season. Returns three starters, six members of the nine-man rotation, and it's a little pointless to project out this far in advance because, I mean, again, we refer back to the way too early top 25 thing of this is more for a laugh than anything serious. But that's a team that I'd be looking at as potentially top 20 6 months from now when they enter the season. And hopefully, one of these years in March, a Mountain West team does something. Because there's been, you know, 22 tournaments since 2000, right? Do you know how many?
21.
I'm counting 2000, my bad. So yeah, okay. 21. Either way, it doesn't change the stat, actually. Do you know how many Mountain West teams have made the Elite Eight in the last 22 years? Zero.
Yeah.
They are 21.9 wins below seed expectation over the last 22 years.
That's weird.
The next worst is the Atlantic 10 at minus 9.3. So almost 13 wins worse than the next worst.
That's weird.
So my theory is just an obvious one. I don't really have a chance to prove it or disprove it unless you take in like Colorado and all Arizona, like all the teams from other high altitude regions. But it's probably the high altitude, maybe, where it's like you go from playing, you know, say you're like Colorado State, you go from playing like 3,000-4,000 feet above sea level to playing in, you know, Nashville or something. Big chunk of your home advantage is gone right there.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I would like to
see
it
happen
once.
Who went the farthest? Nevada with Musselman?
Nevada made it to the Sweet 16. San Diego State made it a couple of times, one with Kawhi. There's been some other runs like scattered throughout.
Wyoming was decent this year.
Sorry?
Wyoming was decent this year.
Wyoming was good this year. Yeah. I liked Colorado State, even though they blew it in the first round.
Yeah.
I mean, Boise State had a really good year and nearly beat Memphis. That's a really good conference. I just want to see them make a run. Let's see it. It feels like it's well overdue for just one of those teams. And San Diego State, you know, why not them? They've been so consistently good for 15 years now, really, after a long time in the wilderness. And it feels like if there was a program in the Mountain West you could say, quote, deserves it, I would point to the Aztecs because they've just been so good for so long that it feels like of all the Mountain West teams that are overdue for a deep run, they're the most.
Interesting. Okay. We'll end on this. Do you have any stats that you've come across in the last week or last 2 weeks because we were off last week that have caught your eye that you've been thinking about?
Yes. So, okay. And this is not calling anyone out in particular, so don't take this as one of my usual mean little things I do where I speak in my nice Midwestern
voice. Oh my God,
voice.
You're an unreal, like, you're just number one bad news deliverer guy. Yes.
Okay, so, you know, certain analysts love to make a big deal of how many players have entered the transfer portal. You know, it's like, it's always like 12 or 1300. I never know the exact number because it literally changes every day. A significantly smaller portion of those analysts discuss how many coaches have entered their own transfer portal. Without looking, do you know how many coaches have changed schools since the end of this past season?
We're talking about everybody? In
everybody, FBA? Including like all the small conferences and whatnot. Just throw a number out there.
75.
You actually reversed it. It's 57.
Ooh, okay.
That's an astounding 16% of all Division I schools that have made a change at head coach in the last 2 months, whether by firing or a coach leaving for greener pastures of some sort. So there's only one school that remains without a signed head coach for the next season. Can you guess who it is? It is a very small school. Throw out a name. I just want to see if you're even in the right region.
San Francisco? Did they hire someone to replace?
They did hire somebody to replace Todd Golden. I think it was just an assistant.
Okay. Texas Baptist?
I wish. No, it is South Carolina State. So their head coach left for Alabama State in April. They have still not hired anybody as of now. So, but that's still, I mean, you think about it, that's one out of every six schools, more or less, that has changed hands in the last 2 months. That's crazy overturn.
That is. Stats by Will. What can the good folks check out from you? I know you're taking a break a little bit with this offseason at statsbywill.com, but anything you'd like to plug as we wrap up here tonight?
In my quest to become more insufferable, I'm posting about the Nashville Predators every two nights. I've got a post in the works about running that I think will be pretty good. I never like to hype up my own work because, I mean, it feels weird to hype up your own work, frankly. Mm-hmm. But post about like distance running and how good it's been for me at some point. Not as like a preachy thing, but just like, I did this, and if I can do it, like plenty of people can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in the works. I don't know. I've been really into running, obviously, but I've been into gardening as of late.
Huh.
I bought a bird watching book this week.
Okay.
So
God,
I'm
we are
moving,
in our 30s.
I'm moving into being 78 years old. So I don't know. Things are going pretty well in this little quote break. So
I love bird watching too, but I got this desktop in my office. It's too big, so I can't see the bird feeder anymore and all my stuff. So I was like, oh, I can't do anything with it. So I don't know. Like, I have to redo my whole office to be able to see back out and see the bird situation. So I don't know. I had to sacrifice it because I was all in, like, getting the Orioles in there and all that. But there were some tragedies because having a bird watching setup and having a lot of bird feeders, it led the hawk to the backyard, and he was familiar with what was going on and all the different people that were coming in and the rabbits and stuff like that. And yeah, I've seen a lot of hawk on other bird crime in the last year living in Knoxville. I remember I was on a run by my house. This was probably like, this might have been last summer, where I was at mid run and I watched a hawk out of the air just snatch another bird and just break its neck and then like slam it on the ground and just like be like banging on the ground, like just really making sure this poor bird was dead. And the woman who's driving behind me, she like pulled, she was like, did we just see what we thought we saw? And I was like, oh yeah, the murder from that hawk, yeah, that was what we just saw. That's what happened there. That was nature. Just be glad we're not in the food chain, we're at the top of it. Yes. Because that poor bird, he was just minding his own business, just flying around. And then the hawk was like, nope, done. And then not even just done. Like, I'm going to bash you into the ground until I'm dead certain that you are a dead bird.
That's pretty metal. That's like in the stop. He's already dead territory.
Yes,
right,
that's
there.
What was happening. Yes.
Oh, that's interesting. So I've never seen that on a run. But it seemingly like one out of every three times I've ran one of the greenways by UT, there's like this family of geese that will come out and like the one is like protecting the, you know, baby geese or whatever. I don't know if they have like a specific name, but
I don't know. I think is their name.
I've been like squawked at and ran after by geese before. It's honestly way scarier than most other situations you can be in running, aside from the obvious.
Yeah.
So, like, when you have geese, when you have a goose like sprinting after you as you're like trying to, it's a real it gets your pace going pretty good.
Yeah. No, they're mean. Geese are just mean.
Yes. Very rude bird.
Yes.
Very, very bad bird.
Very bad bird. I'm not a fan. Yeah, no, not a duck geese fan whatsoever. Will, thank you as always, and I will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas podcast, where I'm now joined by a Major League Baseball writer with ESPN who is in high demand. But thank you so much for being here this afternoon, Jesse. Jesse, how are you doing?
Good, good. Good to be with you. Glad the baseball season's well underway and looking forward to a good pennant race in both leagues. It's been interesting so far. I'm actually a little surprised. Some teams have gotten off to the good starts they have. I thought there'd be a little bit more parity in the first month because of the shortened spring training, but we're seeing the good teams kind of emerge already, so it's been interesting.
Yeah, it seems the division that you cover, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, the Braves got the Brewers this weekend, so I'm excited to see how that unfolds as the Braves continue to try to figure things out there. But with the Cubs, team you're quite familiar with, the NL Central is being talked about a lot. The Cincinnati Reds and their historically awful start. You got the Pirates playing a little bit above their heads early in the season, but Fangraphs gives the Cubs a 2% chance of making the postseason as it stands right now. This was something that was hard because for me, coming into the year with Fangraphs' John Taylor, we were doing our previews and we struggled to figure out what the Cubs were doing. And we were struggling, and I'm sure you were as well, like, okay, why would you be in touch with Carlos Correa if you didn't think this was going to be a year that you could bounce back into it? Then you sign Suzuki, and then you're like, okay, I want to get a read on what Hoyer and company think of their chances in 2022. Has this been about the start that you expected coming into the year based on what this roster finally looked at after everything was said and done?
Yeah, essentially, in terms of their record, I think they're going to end up 5 to 8 to 10 games under 500 for the season. I thought the ceiling would be 80 wins. That was maybe wishful thinking because they're going to make some trades in July, sell off some piece like they did last July. So it's always interesting how you get to your record. But no, I'm not surprised by anything that's gone on. This was always going to be a transition year. Don't worry about who they kick the tires on in the offseason. This is what you have to think about. No matter what point you are in your development as a team, you always have to look under the hood on certain players. Even if outside it doesn't look like it's a fit, sometimes players that you need only come along once in a while. So you might say, well, why do they have Suzuki if they're not competing this year? Well, Suzuki came ready-made without sort of having the pressure to perform right away. This gives him a year to transition. Okay, they'd have to stick him in the minors and figure out if he was a good player. They knew he was. Then cost them a draft pick or in terms of signing a free agent. Like, there's a lot of reasons why. Now, I actually talked to Jed Hoyer yesterday about this. If Suzuki was available 2 years ago, they probably don't pick him up. They had a fully stacked team. So it's about opportunity. And no matter where you are, you kick the tires. What if Carlos Correa wanted to come here at some cut-rate deal because he loves Chicago? You don't say no to that. So don't worry about who they talk to. Just understand the plan. The plan wasn't to push all in this year. The plan was to transition to the next contending team, and one of those parts will be Suzuki. He's young enough and good enough to see him grow in a Cub uniform without the pressure of having to perform right away, because there's going to be a transition period, which is what he's going through right now.
How much does it... So it's interesting because, like, if you're in the AL East, and it's kind of like when we try and create a path for the Orioles to get this rebuild, to get past the most difficult part, which is, like, the transition from just bad to good. And the AL East just being what it is, the Blue Jays aren't going anywhere. The Blue Jays are just beginning their rise and their reign of terror on the AL East. The Yankees are obviously never going to go anywhere. The Red Sox are having kind of a rocky start. They're building themselves kind of a hole. The Rays aren't going anywhere. So when you think about that, yeah, the expanded postseason helps a little bit for these teams that are close, but they're not sure if they're actually playoff teams. But if you're the Cubs, they're in a different situation where you're like in the NL Central and you look at the Brewers and you look at the Cardinals and you're like, well, they're okay, but they're not, they don't have a stranglehold on this division. They're not the elites of the elites, and they have their issues too. We can, with a couple of moves, we can actually expedite this rebuild, and this is more of a retool than what we did the first time to put together that World Series team. We don't have to strip this thing to the bare bones and start from scratch, because this division's winnable, and this division has two teams now who do not plan to win this division for the foreseeable future. And you're like, okay, that's a lot of wins right there, and we can do stuff. Do you think that kind of changed how Jed sees the next couple years and the way the Cubs see the next couple years, just because of the way this division has unfolded in the last couple years?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you worry about the other teams in your division. I think you worry about yourself. Maybe when you're at that contending stage, you might look a little bit more closer. But when you're sort of retooling or rebuilding, you just do your own thing. You mentioned the Orioles. Look, you never know what's going to happen. You could say Toronto's just starting its reign, but an injury here, a bad performance there. Maybe the Orioles – I mean, look, with teams like the Orioles, it has to come from their farm system.
Yeah.
And they do have a good farm system. It has to come from there. And all of a sudden, maybe the Rays aren't always going to be there. They don't spend a lot of money, and maybe one of these years – they'll have some bad scouting decisions and they'll go backwards. Like, you never say never on teams. I understand what you're saying about the Cubs division, but look, Milwaukee has pitching that just can dominate right now. St. Louis is a team that never goes anywhere, so you can't just say it's going to be easy for Jed to overtake those two teams just because the other two aren't in it. So you worry about your own retool, and I don't know. I think it's up for debate whether they're back to 2012 and 13 or not. I like some of the things they've done, but there's a long way to go to really compete, whether it be for the division or a championship. So they're at the beginning of that process. Yes, maybe it can go a little quicker. Maybe it can, especially if you hit free agency. But I don't see a big difference between, let's say, their 2013 team and this team. Maybe it won't lose 100 games because of Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, but in terms of where they are now and where they need to go to really compete, it feels similar. It's a long way.
So you don't expect them to be active in the free agent pool and lock up a big money guy in the next year or two, it sounds like.
No, I disagree with that. That's kind of what I'm saying. You never say never. That I don't think it's going to be that aging veteran like John. Not that John Lester wasn't aging. I don't think it's going to be that final piece or that aging veteran that gets you over the hump. But yeah, if Carlos Correa opts out, sure, they might be interested. If there's another big name, yes, as long as it fits a longer term plan. They're not the 16 Cubs where they're trying to repeat and go for it now. They're in a longer plan. So I think it would be a targeted free agent, but I wouldn't say no to a big name at all. No.
What's been going on with Madrigal? Is there any concern there with his slow start?
I'm not concerned. I haven't really talked to too many Cub personnel about it. It is early. He is coming off an injury. Give him 100 at bats and let's see what it looks like. I don't think you lose the DNA, the type of DNA he has just overnight, meaning major contact hitter. We see it in flashes. We do see it in flashes. So I think that part of his game will return. Now, will he be a 310, 320 hitter with minimal strikeouts? I don't know. We'll see. But I think his DNA is contact, and that will be there. I do think the strikeouts will reduce. I think he is putting a lot of pressure on himself. And that's why, overall, let's use this as a transition year if you're a Cub fan. Let him get the kinks out with his new team and getting past the injury. Let Suzuki get his feet wet here. Let Nico Horner be an everyday starter and be healthy, hopefully. And then he's moved this thing along. All those guys should be better in 23. I know it's not exactly what Cub fans want to hear, but look, I get having a bit of a reset after pushing for years and years and years with the other you know, that other Cub team we saw with the Rizzos and the Biases. So let's use this transition year wisely. If I'm a Cubs brass, that's what I want to see. I want to see progress from the core players, the next core players that will help them contend.
Across town, though, if you're a White Sox fan right now, how concerned are you that this season might be one of those seasons from hell and this is going to be an unfortunate step back, but especially with how the Twins are playing?
I'm a little concerned. Don't worry about the Twins. That's the moment that they're in right now. I mean, the Twins were 4-8 before they swept the White Sox and mm-hmm. went on a run. I'm not saying the Twins won't be there. I just don't think they're that good.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned. It's going to be tougher than last year. That might be a good thing. It's going to be it's going to be more of a grind. That might be a good thing. So you can find some positives. Underneath some of the numbers, though, I don't like the White Sox. Defensively, they're not great. I don't feel like they're deep, deep on the pitching staff, but I could be proven wrong. Guys like Vince Velasquez just had a good start. Matt Foster seems like a guy returning to form. Joe Kelly's going to be there soon. So there's maybe something there on the pitching staff that you're not seeing now that we'll see later. Mm-hmm. I don't think they have enough power from the left side. I think that lineup can be had a little bit when there's a good righty on the mound. It's the same criticism I had last year. But overall, it's still a very good team, very talented. Are they better than their playoff team of last year? Maybe. Maybe. Vaughn's a year older. Sheets is a year older. You know, so is Lance Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that they're considerably better than last year, but they should be just as good once they get rolling. They've had terrible weather. So I'm only slightly concerned with them. But even how they've played these last 4 days is encouraging. They've kind of zeroed in and played better defensively, had better pitching. But let's see how they go on the road against better teams moving forward. They have the Yankees and Red Sox a lot this month. That'll be interesting, even though the Red Sox aren't very good. So I would say I don't think it's going to be the cakewalk they had last year, but that might be a good thing for them.
Yeah, for sure. What's interesting, it's so one of the leading parts of this season has been the lack of offense, right? That there's been a lot of questions as to what's leading to these historically anemic offenses across Major League Baseball right now. Is it the pitching? Is just that good now? Is it the ball? Is it this? Is it going to be the case all year? Based on what you've heard, are folks in Major League Baseball concerned? Are teams concerned about what's going on with the hitting? Does that cloud a lot of what they're like the early season analysis of like, okay, let's see if this is just a weird blip or this is going to be the story of the season, is that this was all about pitching, and if you don't have it, this is the bad, this is the wrong year not to have a lot of important consistent arms?
Yeah, I think people want to wait and see a little bit. I don't think the league is concerned. They actually don't mind if home runs come down a little bit. This is my opinion, because maybe it'll force the contact game back in, and maybe that's why the ball is being a little goofy. Look, it was one thing when Chris Bassett said it, but I've talked to a lot of players since then, and it sounds like there's different kind of balls. Some are hard, some are squishy, some have high seams, some have low seams. It does feel like there's something going on there that's reduced offense. I think weather in the spring is actually getting worse and worse. I'm in Chicago, and it's just been awful. So we have to play it out a little bit. Home runs are going to return, I think, are going to go up. Will they return to pre, 21-20 levels, going back to sort of the heyday of the home runs in the last, 10 years or so? I think we saw that increase. But that was because of the launch angle more than anything. I don't know if pitching is so much better. It's been really good anyway. So is it so much better this year? They had a shortened spring training. Wasn't the pitchers that were supposed to be behind? So I think it's probably the ball and weather related more than anything. And I'd put the ball right up there because I've heard from so many players about it. But
Are they frustrated?
Yeah, they're frustrated with the inconsistency. They just don't know when they hit it hard, is it going to go or not? They'd like to know. And they'd probably like to know, because if it is going to be kind of squishy and there are going to be less home runs, then maybe they start changing their swing patterns.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what the league would like to see, more line drives and less launch angle shooting for home runs. But I know it's early to really know. We need at least another month.
That's wild that we just don't have a consistent idea on like what the ball situation is, that there's not this uniform hey, here's the deal, here's what's going on, and instead we're just kind of left speculating and just talking to different folks. Jesse, what can the good folks check out from you across ESPN this week?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to have a feature on Seiya Suzuki in advance of the Cubs and Dodgers coming on Sunday Night Baseball. Just sort of people getting to know him a little bit. He got off to that hot start, now stumbling a little bit. He talks about searching for a hobby in Chicago because it's different in the States. There's more time on your hands than in Japan. So certain things like that. A little feature on him that's going to drop tomorrow. You can check that out at ESPN.com.
Can you give a blip or a snippet of what that hobby is? What is he? Is he into mountain climbing? Is he
That's the point. He doesn't have
one. Oh, he doesn't have one
yet.
He's
looking for one. So some of his teammates gave me suggestions. It's nothing outrageous, video games, golf. Mm. But it's pretty interesting to hear a player say, we don't practice enough in the States.
Yeah.
Like baseball for most people is still so time consuming when it comes to players. But compared to Japan, it's a lot less over here, and so he's looking to fill his time a little bit. I think the weather being so bad has limited his options as well. It's not like he can go play golf just yet in Chicago. So just little things to get to know about him like that will be in that feature.
Awesome. Well, I will be reading that tomorrow. Everybody else, go check that out. Go give Jesse a follow on Twitter at JesseRogersESPN. And good luck the rest of the way here. And Jesse, we should check back in again soon.
Take care. Pleasure to be.
Great. Here we are. We're back on the Chase Thomas podcast, where I am now joined by a longtime Atlanta Falcon, now 680 The Fan sports radio host, because Brian Finneran loves nothing more than to continue on his day talking more Atlanta Falcons and more Atlanta sports, because he doesn't do it enough in the mornings, Monday through Friday. Brian, how are you doing?
I'm good, Chase. Thanks for having me. And it just, for whatever reason, it parlays into Falcons conversation at some point. So why not just record and put it on the podcast?
Exactly. More content options. Before we get into the Falcons, though, I know you're a Villanova guy. How are you feeling now that it's been a few weeks since Jay Wright unexpectedly retired? Are you still just surprised? Are you still concerned about the future of Villanova football or basketball? Do you think they got the right guy to replace him? Where are you at with Villanova basketball?
I'm good. Jay was there a long time. He did a great job building that program and the culture. National titles behind him, Final Fours galore, NCAA bids all the time, it felt like. So it was an unbelievable run of what, 20 plus years for Jay Wright. So, and then to hand it over to a guy that coached with him, went on to be his own head coach, and now came back to the school that he loved coaching at, is great. So I think they got the good people. They've kept, I think they kept their number one recruit. Mm-hmm. I think, I think Samuels just decided what they got going on. So interesting to see where they go, if they could continue this success that Jay had. And I'm just, regardless of who the coaches, I love Villanova football, basketball, and the school and the environment. So I'm excited about the future for hoops. And, you know, it'll be tough to live up and fill those shoes, but we'll see what we can do.
I think they're going to be all right. I think they're in good shape. Jay Wright's got a solid foundation. I was talking to Jay Billis a few weeks ago on the pod, and he didn't see it coming either. It just seemed like it caught everybody by surprise, which is pretty rare. Usually there's like some sort of inkling or there's some whispers. It's very rare that it's this abrupt and this this big of a change. But, you know, it Well, Brian, so the Atlanta Falcons draft, it's done. It's in the books. And something that I've seen a lot of, and I want to get your perspective on this, is that it was a very physical heavy draft, and that the physical identity that Arthur Smith and Terry Fontenot want to build is kind of coming into fruition a little bit. And there's different perspectives on this as to whether or not this is where the Falcons are going, if they're going after that kind of players. Like, when you look at the draft from top to bottom and how they've handled free agency to this point, do you get the sense that they do really want to establish some sort of physical identity in the next year or two, or do you think that might be a little bit overblown to throw the word physical around with the kind of guys they've brought in thus far?
I think when you think about Arthur Smith and coming from Tennessee and the guys they had up there, offensive line, big bad running back, big physical receivers, I think they like those kind of football players. So I don't think there's any doubt there's an identity they're trying to build. And I think they did that in the draft this year. And I think they'll continue to do that. I think I saw something came out today in an article about the receivers. Quarterbacks are all 6'3 or 6'4 and taller. Mm-hmm. The wide receivers are monsters. You got four tight ends that are over 6'4. It kind of just went into the size and strength of the football team. What they're what they're looking to do and try to be. I think Arthur Smith wants to be a big physical, impose his will kind of football team. And he didn't have that last year, especially on the offensive line. So that was what was surprising for me a little bit, that they didn't address that when they could have with Charles Cross in the first round, and they ended up going with the receiver, Drake London.
So when you, being a wide receiver expert, Brian, when you watch the tape of Drake London, and what did you see? Did you see someone who was worthy of going ahead of Jameson and Chris Olave and Garrett Wilson and just the run of receivers that followed? Like, did you see him as that kind of player at USC? Did you see enough steps? Do you still think that there's more to see this fall? And you have some questions. Where are you at with Drake London and how he actually will fit in Arthur Smith's game?
I think there's always a wait and see type stuff. Mm-hmm. With the draft, especially when you had four wide receivers go back to back to back, when after the Falcons took Drake London, started that little run. But Olave, Wilson, and the other guys, they have more explosiveness. They're faster. They're smaller and quicker, probably. But the things that I liked about Drake London, and I hate to make a comparison, but I thought he played a little bit like I played when I was younger and faster and stronger. I never saw him go backwards. When I watched him play against Oregon, I watched all his catches and most of the game. He never falls backwards. Even when he got guys caught a ball and it was a tight coverage, he would fight for the extra yards or fight to fall forward, which I love in football. I prided myself on kind of always going towards the first down marker and stretching out to try to get it and never letting one guy bring you down. I feel like Drake London has a lot of those same characteristics. More athletic and smoother than I was probably, but still the same type of football mentality. And he brings, and I think Arthur Smith and Terry Fontenot mentioned it, his basketball background was pretty good too. I think it going to the rim and going for rebounds, that kind of stuff resonates and gets you ready for football. And I think Drake has all those aspects. So big, strong body, smooth route runner, fights for the football, jump ball, situation is going to be awesome for him. And then you wait and see. Is he going to have the most?
I'm curious, though, when it comes to what this personnel grouping is going to look like. So you bring in Auden Tate, too. You have Elamide Zaccheaus coming back, and you have I'm curious, what personnel grouping do you think Arthur Smith is going to run? If you had to guess, what percent, is it 10 personnel that they use the most? Do you think it's 11? What personnel grouping do you think Arthur Smith's going to lean on heavily based on where they're at with this roster this fall?
I'm sure your listeners are fairly smart football people, but, 10 personnel is, we went... 21 was two receivers, one running back, and two tight ends or whatever, two running backs at the end. Two receivers, a tight end, and two running backs. So everything's got to add up to five. So 10 is one running back, zero tight ends, and four wide receivers. So I don't foresee the Falcons doing a ton of 10 personnel. In the past, of all the teams in the NFL, when Arthur Smith was an offensive coordinator at Tennessee – and head coach, and head coach now, 12 personnel is one of his favorites. You saw that a little bit last year with Hayden Hurst and Kyle Pitts. And now you'll have Kyle Pitts and big bodies at the tight end spot, but now you got a couple big body receivers too. So maybe see more 11 personnel when you get that one back, one tight end, and three wide receivers where you can move guys around in the slot. That's the other thing they said about Drake London is, they're not afraid to move him at all positions. I think he can play in the slot. I think he can play out wide on the X side, on the Z side. So that's the one thing about football now that kind of drives me crazy, where guys get specialized, even in the NFL. He's a slot receiver. I just don't think that's –
yeah.
Maybe he excels in the slot, but, is Tyreek Hill a slot receiver? The guy can line up anywhere and run past anybody at any point. And they move him all over the field, so –
right.
Move guys all over the place. But I think the Falcons will still use their 12 personnel to get the run game and play action going. You may see more 11 this year with Drake London, Auden Tate, who you mentioned, Zaccheaus, and the handful of other guys that will be there. So If anything changes here, I think maybe a little more 11 personnel, but you still, Arthur Smith will still have that identity of physical kind of smash mouth play action football.
Yeah, and he's got the ex-Tennessee Anthony Fersker there, so we'll probably see him getting a lot of those reps. And I think Fitzpatrick's going to be in that rotation.
That's a good point. Yeah.
But it's interesting you bring that up, because that is something that is like a calling card of Kingsbury to this point, was that you bring in Hop and he is just lined up in the same spot over and over and over again, and he's not doing what Andy Reid's doing, where Tyreek Hill might be in the slot one play, he might be out wide, he might be in the backfield. Like, the reason Kyle Shanahan is so tough to defend is Debo. Mm-hmm. You never know where Debo's going to line up and where he's going to be.
Yep.
And him wanting to be a traditional receiver is like, I imagine how frustrating that's got to be for Lynch and Shanahan, where they're like, that's not where your value is. Your value is the fact that defenses have no idea what we're going to do with you play after play. Like, they just have no idea. Like, you're a Swiss Army knife, and there aren't that many guys like that. But I am, like, that is something that I think is important to note for a lot of folks who don't know the game like you, is that, like, you can be a slot guy in college, but you can move out wide in the NFL. Like, you, the guys who can be versatile, Jameson Williams will be in the slot some in Detroit, but he'll be out wide some too. Like, it's,
yeah,
the best of the best have to be able to move around the field now. I think receivers are just asked to do a lot more now too. Do you think it's changed in that regard, where they're asked to be more versatile than when you came through?
That's a good question. I made it a point to be versatile and be able to know and learn every position on the receiver. Malarkey, when he was our offensive coordinator, Mike Malarkey, my last 3 years in the league with the Falcons, 8, 9, and 10, he put me at tight end. I lined up in the backfield as a fullback the first play of a game against the New England Patriots on the road. Had a 10-yard, 11-yard catch for a first down. It's about creativity, like you talked about, with the offensive coordinators and head coaches, and then the player's ability to be able to be successful and know those positions. I had to learn how to do running back pass protection. I knew if I was back there, because just so that the defense couldn't cue on one thing. Like, I was in the backfield, they assumed I was going to run a route to the flat or run a little check down or wheel route. Well, I learned the protections. I knew that in the two plays or four plays that I was in the backfield, if the linebacker came, I had to pick him up on blitz protection and I couldn't free release. So, so it is about learning. You have to be a smart football player, number one, and then you got to be versatile and big and strong enough and quick enough to do everything. And then you just got to go out there and show them you're capable of doing it all. And I think, has it changed? I think the only change that I've seen is the Debo Samuel type stuff, the Patterson, Cordell Patterson for the Falcons. Tyreek Hill, very creative with those guys. So those guys are special. But I think for the most part, over time, it's been pretty much the same. It's just a matter of the coaching staff trusting a player to know every position.
Is there one guy that you love watching his release more than anybody else in the NFL right now? Like, when you're watching NFL games, do you catch yourself just watching out wide more than you do anything else? Because a lot of people are like, hey, don't watch the ball, watch the line, see where people are lining up. When you watch game tape, are you just like, oh, look at that release? He's not even going to get the ball thrown his way, but that release was just disgusting.
Yeah, every once in a while. And I think Julio Jones was probably that guy for a long time. And obviously, the last few years haven't been the same, but he was a guy where, and Harry Douglas said this to me years ago when they first saw Julio practice back in 2011. He's like, dude is 6'3", 225 pounds. He's fast as lightning, quick as it can be, physical off the line. It was just like DBs were screwed at the line of scrimmage. And if you wanted to come up and jam him, he'd stick you and get a great release. If he wanted to be a couple yards off, he'd pressure his body into you and break off a slant. And there's just no right answer for Julio in the prime of his career. So he's the one that jumped out to me the most. What Jamar Chase did this year, I thought was spectacular. He's so silky smooth, good sized body, big catch radius. So those are a couple guys that jump off the board at me. Odell was quick for a minute when he was having success. But yeah, every once in a while, I'll find myself kind of focusing on receivers, slot receivers, whatever's. The problem is, I don't really subscribe to, and I need to the all 22s that are out there.
Yeah,
where I can see every player at the same time. So when you watch a TV copy, when you're watching the Falcons on TV in a game, you're just stuck watching whatever they show you.
Yeah.
So it's a line of scrimmage and maybe a couple of the receivers or whatever. So, but yeah, those are a couple of guys I like watching and some of the things I notice.
Oh, Finn, we got to get you on the All 22. I don't know what's happening here. We got to, folks, I'll talk to my guys.
I know.
Wire.
I've been meaning to do
it. Small 22, man.
Whatever.
Yeah, it's worth it. I will tell you, All 22 is worth it. The game changer is if we get All 22 for college. Like, that still hasn't happened, and I don't know if that will ever happen. These coaches have no interest in putting all that out there, but that would be great because watching Tennessee games and seeing stuff, especially with Heupel's offense and how fast it is, man, it can be a pain to go back through and go play by play and just to go like to figure out where people were. And it's like, oh, where? What did Velus just line up as? What is he doing? But yeah, that's it. It's a lot. But All 22, man, it's worth it because you'll realize you'll feel differently about like every quarterback in the NFL with All 22. That's what I've learned is you'll feel completely different about what they're seeing and what they're dealing with that you can't see in their regular game feed. You just can't.
Oh, right. No, the moving parts and the adjustments and like, gosh, who was it? I can't remember the first touchdown. Anyway, we work with a guy, Hudson Mason, who.
Yep.
Is spring. Literally went. And shifted from what looked like a quarters coverage. Tight end had a seam route down the middle, and they rotated. They showed the All 22 kind of, and they rotated to cover one high safety, and he had no business throwing it in there. But the tight end was so big, Darnell Washington was so big and strong, he just was able to body up the free safety that was right there. But if you have a better safety or a smaller receiver, it should be an interception or at least a big hit.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Yeah, right.
That's wild. And that's something you can't see without that. Hudson, I think, called one of the Tennessee's games this year. I want to say it was he may have been on the call for the I think it was Tennessee Tech when we blew them out 56-0 or something like that. I remember Hudson, I know, did one of our games, and I think Tennessee Tech was right. And he's a friend of the pod. He's been on the show. Well, awesome. Let's end on this, Brian. So when you look at this roster and where they're at, you get Ritter in the fold in the third round. Good value there. Marcus Mariota, we'll see what camp looks like between those two. Do you think this is still a situation where the Falcons are they're in the cellar this year for 2022?
It's so
funny
that you say that because I just talked about it on my radio show this morning, and we started kind of going over different projections in the 53-man roster, but more than that, we looked at the players that they've brought in, coupled with the draft picks that they got. And I'm going to continue to do this, I think, and I'm going to convince myself that we're not going to be as bad as I thought we were going to be. But who knows? I'm kind of a homer. But when you think about the guys you brought in, you bring in Damian Williams and the Algier
BYU.
Yep, match up with Patterson. So the running back room, I think, is better than it was last year already. The tight end room is going to be nice with Kyle Pitts, regardless of what you do. But you added a guy familiar with the offense and Fursker that you mentioned earlier, and then Fitzpatrick, the big tall kid from Georgia. The receiver room was the worst room in the history of football, hands down. Now you got a couple 6'4", 220-pound dudes. You got Zacchaeus that can run a little bit. It's not quite as bad as I thought it was going to be. The offensive line. It's still a question mark, but you've added competition in Ifedi, and we don't know who's going to be center. Dahlman or Hennessy will be competition there.
Yeah.
Justin Schaefer has an opportunity to make some hay at the guard spot. And then defensively, they brought in some nice pieces on the linebacker spot and D-line. So I'm trying to not get too excited, but I have this team probably definitely drafting in the top 10 again next year. I hope I'm wrong, but the more I look at the roster and watch it kind of be built, and as I get to see him in the preseason and training camp and everything else, I may get a little bit hot on the Falcons. I don't see him being in the top half of the NFL next year with what they got going on right now.
I just think it comes down – like, I wonder how much our perspectives would change if Matt Ryan's still in the building. Like, with this roster as it stands
100%
right
agree.
Now, Yeah, I think that would change a lot of how we were feeling about this. And Ryan throwing to Drake and Pitts and with this running back room, and if the offensive line is significantly better, which they have more depth than they did a year ago. And I mean, is there any way that Jalen Mayfield was as bad as he was last year in back-to-back years? You would hope that he improves a little bit. And if not, you threw another body there in the sixth round in Schaefer. But I don't know. I think
you can't be any worse. I think he gave up 11 sacks, had 9 penalties, and I feel bad for the kid, but that was a disaster. So he can't.
Yeah,
be
I mean,
worse.
I feel bad for Matt Ryan. Like he got a lot of opportunities to stare up at the spaceship above this past year.
That's right.
Unfortunately,
the roof was open. He got a good shot at the stars.
He did. But you know, it's interesting. Are you going to catch yourself? Are you going to like watch every Colts game now? I know you're a big Ryan guy. Is that where you'll put the emotional investment? Because it seems like a lot of Falcons fans are gearing up for the paper bags over their head, and then they're like, our emotional investment's in Matt. Especially if Julio winds up in Indy, like, done deal. Like, if we get Julio and Matt in Indy this summer, and that's just the deal, and that's his swan song is playing with Matt Ryan one more time. Like, there's no doubt Atlanta fans are just all in on the Colts this fall, right?
There's a good chance you'll have some AFC fans NFC Falcon fans pulling for the AFC Colts this year for sure. I want to see Matt be so successful. I want him to do great up there, make the postseason, and give it a little run. So, yeah, 100%. And then if I don't know if you saw Matt smirk a little bit when he was on with
McAfee. Yeah.
And he talked about Julio. You can kind of tell they've been having conversations, and we'll see. Julio, I mean, he's been hurt a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what he thinks he's supposed to be paid this year, but it'll be really interesting to see if the Colts can pull that one out.
Just put him in bubble wrap. Be like, hey, you don't have to play this season. Like, once playoffs come, like, that's when you need to be ready to go. Like, hang out in LA.
You can't
fall,
do that
we'll
in football.
You. Yeah, you can't. But like, that's the thing, is I would just be like, Julio, you're a first ballot Hall of Famer. We love you. We're going to win this division. The AFC South sucks. Like, we can do it without you, but we just need you come playoff time. So whatever you got to do to stay ready, like, even just give him a DMP rest. Like, we see this in the NBA all the time now. Just give him some, what's it called? Not rest. What is the term that they use now for everybody? DMP, oh my goodness. It's not, there's an actual term that I can't think of what it's called now.
I can't remember.
But it's not rest, but they have another word for it they get out of it that makes it sound a lot better of DMP did not want to get hurt today. But yeah, that's something that I think is a possibility. But I mean, you also had Matt. I think y'all had him on, what, right after the trade? Was that a month ago?
Yeah, we did.
Time flies, but he seems like a likable dude. And I love that he waited until he left to open up and just go, like, here's everything about Matt Ryan. I'm actually cool and funny and I have a lot more personality. He waited until he was gone to open up the personality, which I thought was interesting.
You know, when you get to your 15th season in the NFL, you learn a lot about yourself and what you can say and not say, and how you want to present yourself as a quarterback in the league. So I think that's part of it. And then the fact that McAfee's so outgoing and a former Colt, he opened himself up to that. And then when guys jump on these podcasts anymore, some crazy shit happens. They're just like, people start saying stuff they shouldn't be saying. They start talking out of line, and things get people's feelings get hurt. And it's a really fascinating medium that has taken over, specifically in the sports world, which is kind of fun to see guys open up a little bit. But you also got to be careful what you're doing.
Yeah, teams don't like it. Just as a FYI, with my experience in booking, like, it's a complicated thing because, I mean, I get their perspective where it's like the best case scenario is it stays neutral. You don't rock the boat at all. The worst case scenario is that just something comes out, then you have to address it all week long. There's no positive to any of this. There's no, so they're doing you a solid because they know, like, everybody knows, like, there's no good thing that can happen to the team. The best case scenario is neutral. Brian, we can listen to you on the locker room 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. Anything else we can plug before we wrap up here today?
Sure. You can check me out on all social media platforms at bfinn86. BFINN 86. And then if you like what you hear and you like a Falcon fan, and we got a good morning show here in Atlanta called The Locker Room, you can tap that app, download it at 680thefan.com.
There you go. Go do that. I listen to it. It's one of my favorite things, and I miss all my 680 fam. But the app, it works. So when I'm running and I'm doing my stuff during the day up here in Knoxville, Tennessee, mm-hmm. guess what? I have the app and I can just check back in right there. Brian Finneran, awesome. Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate you making the time for me today. And you have yourself a great rest of your week, and we'll have to check back in again soon.
Sounds good, Chase. Appreciate you.
All right, y'all. That'll do it for the Friday, May 6th, 2022 edition here on the Chase Thomas Podcast. Thank you again to Brian, Jesse, and Will for coming on today's edition of the podcast. Sorry for a little bit of technical difficulties with the last two. Our streaming service for the interview with Jesse, for whatever reason, flipped to my desktop sound. So I did not know until after we recorded that it was using my desktop mic instead of my studio mic. So that's fun, but got resolved for the second one, but there was some technical difficulties as you guys heard a little bit with Brian, but that it's okay. It all worked out, and I think we still had some great conversations, and it was still a good time. And I appreciate Brian, Jesse, and Will for coming on this edition of the podcast. That was great. Don't forget, folks, if you enjoyed today's episode, guess what? This show comes to you live every single day. New content in your podcast player every single day. You can go check us out, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and support all the other great programs over there at Blue Wire, bluewirepods.com. Chris Long with Greenlight, Spinsters, with Jordan Liggins and Haley O'Shaughnessy, and then Chris Van Fleet with Insight, just all kinds of great programs over on the Blue Wire Pod Network. So go ahead and check them out if you have not already done so. You can also check us out on YouTube. Please do. It's really easy to find the Chase Thomas Podcast on YouTube and support us and share it out and all that good stuff. You can email this very program at chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com. And also, if you've noticed, the last few weeks, every episode goes out 3 a.m. East Coast time for all the commuters and all that good stuff. So just know, check your podcast player that, hey, the Chase Thomas Podcast will be consistently in your feed at 3 a.m. East Coast time, midnight West Coast time, all that good stuff, so that there's some consistency, so you guys know when to expect the next episode to drop. Subscribe, supportrenaissanceman.substack.com, and yeah. All right, new episode should come tomorrow. We're going to see graduate school finals are happening here at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, so I've got a lot on my plate over the weekend, wedding to attend to on Saturday night, but going to try and get it all in, and we'll see what happens there. You guys be well, and I will talk to you very soon. Uncle Derek, how'd I do?
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.